You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
There is a sadness I feel and don't often talk about. I don't know how to fix it. It doesn't excuse anything, but to add to all that, times were rough. The sun rose, the sun set, cars rolled past me and people carried on. I don't know why we're born, but I think a lot of people waste so much time not thinking about what they could do to make the world a little better, make their own lives a little better, even though I didn't know how to make mine any better than it was. I worried that I would die in my car, that I would die unfulfilled, or that I would die and not know what an easy day felt like. I worried that if I ever did, I would still not be happy inside.
Priya Guns is an actor and writer, and she's been published in short story anthologies including Gal Dem, Spring Magazine, and anonymously in The Guardian. She's a creative writing graduate from Kingston University. Her debut novel is Your Driver is Waiting. Thank you for joining me, Priya.
Thank you for having me.
I love the voice in this novel. It really carries us through. It's a fantastic work told from, all in the first person. The character is Damani. She's a driver for an Uber-like service, lives with her mother. Not in the best of circumstances. Paycheck to paycheck is an exaggeration. It's like she's flying that paper airplane from paycheck to paycheck.
Basically, yeah.
But what I liked most about this book was that tying the whole thing together, for me at least, was that a sense of pragmatism all through it. The Damani is really living in the real world, and she has to deal with everything and on a day-to-day, thing-to-thing, what-I'm-doing-now basis, but also understands that she's captured by much larger forces than herself. And the pragmatism that runs through this novel is really interesting. Could you talk about creating a character who's, you know, I thought kind of like lives a life based on pragmatism and reality?
I was thinking a lot about just activist spaces and protest in general, and seeing, for example, I was really inspired by what they call the revolution, so Thawra in Beirut in Lebanon, or in Lebanon on October 2019. That's where I was living at the time. And just seeing how it was amazing seeing everybody come together to protest against the government beyond their own sectarian beliefs, but then seeing within the context of a protest and mass demonstrations, how people who are marginalized tend to become more marginalized and don't necessarily have access to the same spaces. So for instance, refugees, Syrian and Palestinian refugees weren't really invited into those spaces and were told in many accounts, you know, this is not for you, this is not your fight. And then migrant domestic workers were at home taking care of people's kids. And it just made me really think about the space that we have. And then people who, you know, are struggling like Damani is day to day, paycheck to paycheck, not even having the ability to fight for their rights or scream for what it is that they need, because they need to use that time to work. They can't afford to take time off. I mean, with Damani, because her father has recently passed away, she doesn't have the headspace to think beyond the now. She doesn't have the time to even reflect and process her grief. And so the way she views the world is very much in the moment and what's happening.
I love all the characters in this book. And particularly Amma and Appa, I talk about creating these characters who are really sweet, wonderful characters in a world that is decidedly neither sweet nor wonderful.
I think it was important to have the parents, so Amma and Appa, and I think it's the reality. I mean, people are lovely and they're sweet, and unfortunately we live in this very, very dark world. And I mean, one route, so I mean, before actually penning anything down, I anticipated that the book would be very dark. Possibly Damani would do something horrendous to her mother, and she does get a little out of hand in some chapters. But, you know, speaking to my editors and friends about it, the world is just so dark. They thought, or they, we had talked about how, you know, when you escape through fiction, you kind of want to experience something a little different, or perhaps our realities and shone in a different light. So yeah, sometimes I think Dominique's relationship with her mom is quite complex, where there is a lot of frustration and anger, but at the same time, there's so much love. And because of the situation and her being a carer, having to take care of her mother, I mean, she doesn't necessarily, there's a lot of tension between them, but you can, I hope you can feel the love at the same time. So it is funny. You say that her mom's very sweet. Writing Dominique seeing her mom is, oh my God, you're just this nuisance.
But I think you do a good job at creating that sense of love. I want to circle back to something you said, that the world is so dark. And that's one of the things I really loved about this novel. One of the giant fringes, I think, of literary execution these days are dystopian novels, and they're generally set in the future, and the typical plot line is that civilization is broken down and a few great heroes are going to rise up out of this civilization and make things great again. This novel is also a dystopian novel, but it is set firmly in the present. The apocalypse has come, but it just went unnoticed in the general haste. We are going to call it a pericalypse. So talk about writing a novel that's set in both reality, but your attitude or your character's attitude towards it is that, you know, the end has come.
Yeah. Basically, I think you can have so much fun in a dystopian world, like using sci-fi. There's so much that we can mask behind different elements of fiction and craft in general. But I mean, for me personally, being a bit of an existentialist from a very too young. I was like 8 years old when I realized, you know what? This is not right. I thought it was actually really fun to almost highlight things that I was seeing and imagining being Dominique in a car. I think taxi drivers, I mean, they have insight like no one else in the city. They go through, they know all the alleyways. They know all the places you got to go to find whatever story you need. And so using her literally as a vehicle to go through this very, very grimy, dark, cold city, even though it's summer, there's just something quite cold about it. It was a lot of fun. And it was also like chapters are different rides. And for me, at one point, I'm like, maybe I should add something here or change something there. And I'm like, but this is the life of a driver. This is how it rolls, you know?
Speaking of which, have you yourself been a driver?
So it's really funny. I don't have my license. I wanted to sit, I could drive a car, I could drive stick too. I wanted to sit in a car, with a rideshare driver, but it was during lockdown that I started writing. And so it was impossible. My partner was a cab driver and comes from a family of cabbies. So hearing stories and always talking about the business and that, I mean, since rideshare companies like Uber, Lyft, and the likes have come into the scene and they've changed the whole taxi economy in itself. I've had that experience. But I took driving lessons. I learned to drive stick properly while writing the book. And it was really funny because I'd have my instructor say things like, okay, you need to imagine that you're your character. She's going to be, you know, she's going to stay within the line. She's not going to drive too fast because apparently I have a bit of road rage. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. This is perfect. I just got to channel this and write it down.
You know, one of the things that I found so interesting in this novel was the sense of the economy that your character has. And I think what's interesting in this novel is that once it's a love story, very specific between two people, it's also a story where the protagonist and antagonist are abstract forces of capitalism and, you know, the innate sense of democracy among any gathering of people. And I'd like you to talk about balancing between the abstract and the very specific.
I like this question. It was challenging because I didn't want to create, you know, such polarization and a caricature of either character, but I also wanted it to be fun. And I, of course, you want to shine a light on something. I don't know in terms of, I don't know if I can judge my own execution on that besides saying, you know, sharing some of my thought process. I thought a lot about, like, I mean, it's not so much, so there's these two characters and one is Tamil and one is white, but it's not so much about their race where they're at conflict. And that was really important to me. So thinking beyond somehow one might assume the other may behave, and even thinking of, okay, so if Jolene was the driver and Domini was the woman out protesting, how would their dialogue change? So just kind of in my mind, thinking more of the abstract, and playing with it in that from there. But my editors were lovely in helping formulate, particularly Jolene's character, because it was important to me to get her right.
You know, reading is a matter of looking at sentences and letting them go into your eyeballs one after the other and enjoying them. And I have to say that the prose in this book and is just super enjoyable. The sentences are, like, you know, alternately packed with a kind of really wry and dry sense of humor, but also, like, with really keen observations about specifics and the abstracts, as we talked about. Talk about creating the prose voice for this character, which is incredibly memorable and really enjoyable.
I dug deep. It was really exciting because, of course, this is my debut novel. I've written two novels before, but I knew, okay, yeah, this is going to get published. I knew that before actually writing, so I had a deal before, is what I'm trying to say. But I dug deep too, so I did a lot of reflection. I mean, my life growing up, I had to mask a lot. I had to keep a lot inside. So it was almost like you're living multiple lives. You know, I come from a very or somewhat conservative background. I'm bi, I'm quite political in a very apolitical house, even though we escaped a war. And that is the case for so many different reasons. So I very much learned at a young age how to be the right version of you that is necessary for particular rooms. And so it was just like, okay, find that voice that when you're at a party or when you're, I don't know, at work and you're just suppressing everything that you want to actually say, and then playing with that. That's basically what I did. And also I've had, I enjoy acting, and I do the best I can. But for me, what I learned with Domini is I was, you know, playing her in the mirror. And it was funny because, her voice would come out when I wasn't working and I'm on the phone with someone or I'm sending emails. And I'm feeling the same way now as I'm working with a new character on my second book. But I think for me, pretending to be this character really helps in getting in their minds and playing with their voice. Because sometimes, for instance, you wake up and you're like, okay, I'm going to do this chapter and this is what's going to happen. And you think this is what's going to happen, but then the character surprises you and they say something and you're like, whoa, okay, that's intense, or that's not, or you're actually quite sensitive. But yeah, no, it was a lot of play. I had a lot of fun.
This novel has been compared, not without reason, to the movie Taxi Driver. And you, this, when you described yourself talking to the mirror to write it, that's certainly one of the most famous scenes from that movie. But I think that what you do a really good job of playing with that association. There are times when the prose, the things you say about the city, just ring in your mind in the same way some of that narration in Taxi Driver does. But it's different. I'd like you to talk about that kind of going back and forth between what inspires you and what you are, what from without, and what inspires you from within, and how you channeled that voice.
Okay. So So I absolutely love the film Taxi Driver. I think it's a piece of art. It's fantastic. And it's one of the few films that I watch from beginning to end in one sitting. And I mean, after watching it, I had so many thoughts, and I realized that I tend to gravitate towards characters, or enjoy depictions of characters that are struggling with some sort of alienation and depression and feeling very far removed from society. And I think Robert De Niro did an excellent job. So did Scorsese, of course. And I asked myself, like, what is it about this character that I'm drawn to? Why is it that these characters that are seen as these anti-heroes, basically, why am I drawn to them? And for me, I realized that it's this idea of alienation. But of course, it had to be different, because the alienation that I feel personally, or that I can prescribe to my character, is not going to be from the same base necessarily as that of Travis Bickle. I mean, they're both angry at the system, but then what they do in order to try and change something, what Travis does ends up working for the system, where he's deemed a hero. What Domini ends up doing, there's a debate between whether she's a terrorist or not. You know, there's one actual hero and there's one that's going to be kind of doomed. I don't know if I remember the rest of your question, but I thought a lot about place and time, you know, in terms of their frustrations and their motivation.
The city you create has no name, yet it feels very familiar. And I love this kind of city with no name, because it's essentially, you know, a landscape of the fantastic, where we never know what's going to happen and what exactly is real or not real. And this brings me to one of my favorite locations in the city, Doo-Wop. Talk about creating Doo-Wop and the people that Domani meets there, Sharif and the other characters, and how that happened for you as a writer and as a person too.
I think Doo-Wop for me is kind of symbolic of hope and possibility. And in writing this city that is very, you know, it's dark, it's a dark place, and people are sort of uprising slowly. And the antagonism against those protesters that exist is just all very tense. I felt like offer something a bit different and offer a possibility, offer something that potentially we can, you know, yes, and. I mean, these places exist, and normally people within a particular community or space or location know about that place, but it's not something you can necessarily Google, for instance. And Doo-Wop for me, just them reusing an old factory and people coming together without judgment to have conversations, hard conversations, to learn about the society they live in, to learn, I don't know, even how to write a resume, to just be where you can truly be, is what is something, somebody says something like that. I thought that was very important to balance out the doom and gloom. And I think just generally speaking, in terms of the life we live every day and considering our times right now, it's important to have that sense of community, sense of belonging, and finding that somewhere, because we're not alone. And there's so many people who do feel the pain. And I mean, sometimes I'm just like, this is not even real. Like, what's going on? How is this happening? I thought maybe in, like, I don't know, 2 years we'd be dealing with what we're dealing with right now, but it's a lot. So Doo-Wop is definitely the window of, I guess, fresh air or for some air.
You know, that idea of I thought we'd be dealing with in 2 years what we're dealing with now. I mean, I thought that maybe my granddaughter, who's 1 year old now, would be dealing with the things that we're dealing with right now and saying, oh, Grandpa used to walk on the beach every day. Now that beach is gone. I'm telling you, that beach is gone today.
Yeah. Just like in terms of planet, in terms of what's going on our planet ecologically, what's going on with people in different communities. Just everything. Just everything. I'm not going to get into specifics.
Now, but however, your character, one of the things I love about Domani, and this is a really interesting technique to drive things forward, is that this book, in a sense, is a series of admissions by her. She admits to having pretty much every fault you can imagine. And that, you know, her reasons for having them are, you know, understandable. So talk about writing a book that is, in a sense, it's a confessional.
I guess I'm really interested in confessionals and admissions to certain, to natural human behavior. The things that we would do given being put in particular situations, I think is very intriguing. I think when we assume that something is a crime, or even, I mean, crime in general and laws that exist, I think they're so questionable, and we can unpack them and unpick them, because who do they serve? Why do they exist? What are we protecting? Who are we protecting? These layers fascinate me. And at the end of the day, like I said, maybe someone would deem Dominie a terrorist or say that she's done something unforgivable. But I was trying to show, well, this is where she comes from. This is how she's been oppressed. Kind of putting the mirror to the reader, I guess, to ask, hey, what would you do if you were in the same situation?
That's sort of fascinating, because in a sense, as a reader, you know, I haven't thought of it that way, but that's how I actually read it, or how I experienced it, that you're reading this and thinking, as you go, well, how would I react in this situation? Makes sense to me what she's doing. Makes sense to me.
The thing in fiction, though, is like, I probably wouldn't do that. But if you have the opportunity to write it out and imagine it in the confines of a book, why not? Let's go. Hit the gas.
Hit the gas. All right. Well, that's appropriate for this book. Your driver is waiting. You talked about the refugees, this like camp outside the city. And I think having that like off stage really, you know, for much of the novel works really, really well. It's H.P. Lovecraft, who was an old writer of cosmic horror, always thought the idea was to create a nebulous thing outside of reality and then show one toenail that would indicate how terrifying that whole thing is. And you do a really good job with that. Would you talk about creating representation of forces that are powering the plot of the novel, as a sense, offstage from much of the novel itself?
I love these questions. This was really important to me because I was thinking of, you know, just society and superstructures and how our society functions. And if I'm talking about, or if I'm showing the story that is actually quite domestic, I hope that I can show you the politics within the relationships of these people and characters and where the frustration comes from. So for instance, when you mentioned the refugees, there is a scenario or something that has happened. And the implication is that it is this particular incident that has been the last straw. It is this incident that's happened that has made everyone say, despite what they believe, everyone kind of coming together and saying, F everybody. This is it. I don't even care anymore. The fact that this has happened to real people and no one is being held accountable, and we don't have really much control because we live in this metropolis and this is on the outskirts. This is the peripheries. Like, for me, all of this is fascinating. Yeah. And that was really, really important, because I think if I'm writing a story, for me as a writer, I ask myself, like, why are you doing this? What do you want to say? How do you want to say it? I think about, ultimately, for me, the politics of a story is very important in showing not just the domestic, but showing that ultimately we live within a system that is bigger than ourselves. And everything that happens on the outside, whether we are aware of it or not, we enable the system to function in these particular ways that serve us. And I think being able to just clue into that every now and then is very, very important. And I think now we're living in a time where it's in your face, where it's like, you don't need to buy that coffee from Starbucks, and this is how it might help. You know, I think people haven't asked these questions enough, perhaps. I don't know.
They haven't. You know, I really like that Damani's intense immersion in weightlifting and in making her body like strong like a man, not mm-hmm. like a woman, so she can defend herself. But it's not just for self-defense. It's something more within her, some vision of her own self that she's always heading for, but will never hit. But she wants to still keep going in that direction, because going in that direction of self-improvement results in self-improvement.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny because I have some people, the way they describe Damini is like, oh yeah, she's super ripped. And I'm like, actually, she's not. Like, she says, oh yeah, I can lift my own body weight. I've been training for 6 months. No, she's not that ripped, but she really enjoys lifting. And the reason that she got into it is because she couldn't help her. She couldn't pick her mother up. You know, it was that paramedic who came in and was completely misogynist, and being a driver, there's a part where she says, you know, you have a house, I'm stacked. And basically people come into the car and they don't realize or see that I can lift twice my weight or whatever the line is. It was definitely a way for me to show that this was how she could gain some sort of control and feel in control of something. But it was also massively a shield and kind of a way she could psych herself up every single day to say, I'm doing this night ride, I'm doing it. And I'm tough. And also lifting weights is like that. I think people go into it and they're like, oh, I don't want to be like those people. But once you start lifting, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You feel good. I mean, even when you start running or doing anything active, you tend to feel really good, only it's gotten to her head a bit.
Yeah, it can be problematic. You can wind up on the beach with two dogs at 5 a.m. in the pitch black, and it starts to rain. You think, well, maybe this isn't the best idea.
Yeah.
At one point, your character, you write, the mirror said no, but we all know mirrors can be deceiving. And I love this kind of writing that you drop in all the time. Talk about creating, you know, this sense of self using, you know, the mirror of prose. This book is a big old mirror, and the only thing that we can really say for sure we see in it is you.
You as in?
You, the person I'm talking to.
Like, who are we talking about? I don't even know how to respond to that. It's nice to hear all of this, like I said, as I'm working on novel 2 and I'm kicking myself every other day, like, oh man, I don't know if this is any good. I don't know what I'm doing. I think a lot of it is play and experimentation. And yeah, kind of, I learn a lot about my writing when I'm in these interviews. I had someone ask me, oh yeah, you play a lot with music. And I'm like, oh, I guess I do. yeah, I don't have anything better to offer, and I sort of already forgot some of the questions.
Okay, well, this is a novel that makes one think about how one presents to others. As a result of all the inner monologues, could you talk about that idea of how we are inside and how we present to others, and how we try to, understanding how we are inside, we try to channel out what we want others to see, so we present in a certain way, because this is very important, especially with regards to Damani and her would-be lover, Jolene.
Mm, I'm also thinking about Damani and just being a driver and being a woman. And when certain people get into the car knowing, okay, I'm going to not wear my seatbelt, because actually if you wear your seatbelt, you can easily get strangled from the back. Or, you know, being a lot more lighthearted when kids are in the car, projecting a form of self, like with Miss Patrice, who is an elderly rider that she has. And she's very sweet, even though she still tries to like steal things from her bag. And then with Jolene, to answer your question, Damini is almost, she's dealing with a lot of conflict, because they're from very different places. And it's almost unbelievable to Domini that Jolene even wants to spend time with her. And the interesting thing is that Jolene wants Domini as she is, because that's what almost makes her, you know, I guess, exotic, or makes her that much more desirable to Jolene, because Jolene sees Domini as someone she can help.
You know, love story in this is really well done. Talk about creating these intense feelings of attraction, you know, the instantaneous hit that you can sometimes get from just seeing somebody or talking to them. You might talk to somebody for years, and then all of a sudden you'll just get a hit and go, oh my God,
I'm in love. I'm in love. I love you so much. I got poems on my notepad. This was a lot of fun for me, and I just love obsession. I myself have obsessive tendencies, and I think I like to call it passion. It's just a very, very two passionate people who probably need therapy. That's Jolene and Domini. It's very, very intense. It's almost borderline cringe. They need each other. They both need each other for different reasons, and they don't see it or understand it at that time. But yeah, it's very intense. They have a lot of fun at the beach, which was a lot of fun to write as well.
You know, one thing I noticed about the plotting in this novel is you do this kind of a seesaw thing where we'll see one scene, Domini at a party that Jolene has invited her to, and then we think, okay, she's dealing with that pretty well. And then you take the seesaw goes the other way, and Jolene comes to where Domini feels comfortable, and we see, uh-oh, things are going out of control. And that's one of the feelings I love about this book, is all the moments in this book where you go, uh-oh.
I think just like the back and forth. I wanted to also show with the specific example that you've given that Domini is a lot better at sort of changing and transforming herself and personality. She knows how to tone down parts of herself, as she says, depending on who she's with and where she is. Whereas Jolene, she's very much consistent with who she is. Like, this is me. And yeah, when she goes to Doo-Wop to hang out in, which is Domini's space, that's where the big conflict kind of slowly explodes. Because she's just incapable of being there and just chilling out a bit. She gets very upset.
Talk about, you know, just creating the romance between these two women. It's something that we don't read it. Or we used to not read every day. So how did you approach that? And, you know, mixing the physical parts and the mental parts and balance them out so that we can feel the tug of both.
So I was rereading Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Mask. And there's two chapters, I think, The White Woman and The Man of Color, and The Woman of Color and The White Man. And they're interesting chapters, and they discuss sort of the dynamics between these two people and why those dynamics would be the case. And for me, I was thinking, well, what would it be like if it were, you know, if we queerified this with a huge class analysis, basically. And so in writing their dynamics, I was thinking about the very real of what their jealousies might be towards each other even, or how they might actually view each other in terms of even beauty standards and how one views the other physically. I turned to a lot of theory and then, of course, real life experiences myself and talking to friends and just through life, really, chatting to, this is what they say, you got to live a little and then write.
I really like the way you work with abstract, the capitalism in this book. Talk about, you know, taking that abstract, making it both real and also, you know, not into and discussing the big abstract things in abstract ways, which is the way they need to be discussed sometimes, just so we understand, you know, that we're inside the jaws of the crocodile. Eventually, we'll see the gullet and the rest of the digestive system if we don't do something soon.
Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, so thinking back to abstracts, I like to play with the absurd. I like to play with what is just so mundane, and you kind of, I don't know if it happens to everybody, but for me, sometimes it's just you're in a room or you're with people or you're walking outside and you see an advertisement, and it's just the way things exist within public space, and then the uses of private space. For me, all of this is very strange. So zooming in on something that I think is actually very absurd, I think helps in showing the abstract of a bigger idea. That's what I think. I don't know if that's true or not.
It did in this novel. that it certainly worked that way. You know, you've used the word spaces a few times in this discussion, and that made me think about, you know, the incredibly, on one hand, the city is this big hole, and it has everybody who lives there captured. I mean, nobody's going nowhere. On the other hand, there are really different worlds within this city, spaces. And so talk about the creating, and I think you do a wonderful job of taking us from Damani's space slowly into Jolene's space and then back out again. And finally, we kind of see each in it their own distilled nature. Talk about moving between those spaces, yet staying within the world of the city where everybody lives.
This is interesting that you mentioned I use the word space quite a lot. And I'm thinking, like, my background, well, I majored in geography. I was a geography teacher. And thinking about space, we're always using, like, space, place. And what does this mean? You know, there's, like, the reality outside physical space and even within the, like, the, I'm not even going to say the confines of the internet, just the vastness of the internet in itself is a space that we, it's not tangible. It just exists within our hands or in our, on our screens or whatever. But the moving, I think naturally parts of the city, everybody kind of feeds each other. Like, we're like mycelium, right? But it's concrete and it's through messaging or it's through phone calls or it's through being connected on an app. For instance, just thinking about Damani and her physical space of the car, like that's the only place that's truly hers. And she's completely atomized being a rideshare driver, but she can move. And the people who are using the app are from different places of the city. And where she's going to get the most pings is where there is the most money, in the central business district, the CBD. So using my geographer brain, like the way cities are constructed, there's a CBD, there's an inner city, you're talking about the periphery, the urban sprawl into the suburbs and the spread of that. But when you think about who lives on the outskirts, who lives in the inner cities, who is moving, so drivers even living in lower economic areas and then driving long distances to then wait in parking lots for potential riders. And then when I think about the space of the parking lot, this is kind of going in different places, but that being an occupied space too, because what was there? It wasn't concrete. We're talking about destruction on different levels. I'm going everywhere with this, but I think naturally in cities, the movement of people is very organic. And in order for the city to function, you're having people who are being exploited or who aren't being paid what they should be for their time in service of somebody else and for their capital and profit. You need certain groups of people. You need the majority to be in the city, and then they're moving out. So then the relationship between them and the movement is something that I'm thinking about right now. And obviously, I'm having fun with this question.
One thing that it struck me too, I'll just read a little paragraph. Salmon is a big fish and expensive. Maybe it had feelings because it was that big. this one time when I took a bite of the coral flesh, in the second I closed my eyes, I had scales and jumped 10 feet high from the salty ocean water. When I landed, I was somewhere else, missing narwhals and leatherback turtles while stuck in a cage, rubbing up against the other salmon, seeing chunks of my body fall off my skin as sea lice ate me alive. Maybe I should stop eating salmon. Maybe it's a crime. What a wonderful
piece of writing. Talk about, you know, just the use of reverie to advance. You know, and this is a wonderful case where a very specific reverie advances a big piece of the plot, the abstract plot.
I love your questions, because I'm thinking, I never saw it necessarily. Like, as the writer, I don't go in seeing it this way, right? It's very different. I'm in the mind of this person and I'm like, okay, she's sitting down and she's having fish with her mom, and they're not having salmon, they're having sardines. And I mean, the part about the salmon is very true. This is what happens when we have these massive fish farms and salmon farms, and they're just getting diseases, and it's terrible. I watched this documentary and I was like, oh my God, that's wild.
It's not wild.
I don't know. No, it's not.
It's the factory, the salmon factory.
Exactly. I don't know. I guess there's things about our everyday life, just, you know, being human. And for me, I guess in finding connection and reverence to even the natural world, is I feel like where Domini and perhaps where a lot of my characters that I will be writing find some sort of grounding. And it takes some, I'm trying to think of this particular scene. Where does Domini go? She decides that it almost like it justifies anything that she could possibly do. Cause it's like, if we're letting this happen to salmon, nobody, you know, I mean, what does it matter?
You know,
other things.
In the movie Videodrome, there's a kind of evangelist type character who keeps talking about, you know, the better world. And in your novel, you have Dr. Thelma Herman Hess, which I thought, what a fun name, what a fun character. And I love this, use of an avatar to speak directly to the reader through the voice of the character who's experiencing this. It's like you, the author, are whispering into the character's ear via Dr. Thelma Herman Hess.
terrible advice.
I take it you've read a bit of Herman Hess.
I love him. I adore him.
Okay, so talk about the influence of that and the way you weave it into this novel with a terrible advice.
Well, firstly, this character, Dr. Thelma Herman, has had to exist because Domini needs help. And I wanted to show that she clearly needs help, but she can't afford help. And the only place where she can find help is through this online doctor. We don't know if she's actually a doctor. And her name is Dr. Thelma Herman Hess. And I changed the spelling. I wanted to start, did I want to pay homage to Herman Hess? Maybe a little, but at the same time, I wanted to show how somebody who actually has quite a sound mind can then be co-opted into this character who is the complete opposite and gives terrible advice and has cheesy videos with all these changing screens behind her. And is just like, yeah, just breathe in and out and everything's going to be all right. You'll be fine. Blow your nose out in like this bounty sheet and just do that a few times a day and all your problems will dissipate.
You know, I just heard a blurb on NPR where that was pretty much the advice, is every once in a while, just stop and take a break.
I mean, we should take a break.
I think, uh-oh, bad advice if you're driving on the freeway at 70 miles an hour, huh?
Yeah. Let's take a break, just like hang out, have a picnic, hold
what,
hands.
You know, here's another line from your novel that I think summarizes, in a sense, the intent of the novel. I tried to hear her voice in my head, but it hurt my head to think about what she may have felt. And I think that's the goal of maybe this novel and every novel, is to get us to think about what people might have felt and why they might feel that way and why that's perfectly reasonable. In fact, it's a good idea for them to feel that way.
Yeah, I think that if I ever write anything and it irritates someone so much and they're so outraged, for whatever reason, I think I'll be like, that's fine by me. That's okay. I mean, I'm learning and figuring things out as well. We're all learning.
Hopefully.
Yeah, easier, hopefully. I mean,
easier said than done.
Yeah. We're just going to take a break every now and then, breathe a bit.
Yeah.
And sing, I am learning. I am learning. And that's how it works.
I'm resetting. We're all just like our computers. All you have to do is restart us and our voice sounds just fine.
Restart us a few times. Sometimes.
Of course, as Esten Salim once said, all the parts of the body assembled are in perfect health are not so great if mind directing them is completely crazy. And that is often the case. One of the things I think that works really well in this book, I love the character, I'm going to butcher his name, who's the driver, leader of the
Sharif.
Sharif, yes, Sharif. Mm-hmm. Talk about creating this character. He's a really wonderful, you know, of the characters in this book, he seems like perhaps the most grounded and, you know, really, like, I guess, righteous character in that, you know, reasonable. And reason is important in this book.
I love that you say he's the most reasonable, because I was going to say he is my radical revolutionary voice. he is that person on the page that had to be there to ignite some sort of dialectic. Yeah, no, I love Sharif. I wish that I did write some other chapters just for myself to get to know him. I think that Sharif was the perfect vessel in the book to open the dialogue to different types of conversations. And I mean, even thinking about it from like a craft perspective, I don't ever want to sound didactic. And this is something that I was thinking a lot about. But then the reality is that so many of us, we're having these sorts of conversations. We're talking about our labor. We're talking about our time. We're talking about what it is that we can do. We're talking about what we're seeing. And that's the reality. So when I was, I thought a lot about literary critics from just research that I was doing before writing. And then what's deemed didactic for me seems something that actually is very real that we're talking about. For example, seizing the means of production in Sharif's case.
Well, I mean, that is often a benefit to the means of production, since I enjoy buying my flour from King Arthur's Flour, which is an employee-owned company. And I think that, you know, what's wonderful about this novel is a page-turning joy to read because of the great prose and the wonderful characters and, you know, the kind of forward, back, and tipping plot. Who is crazier and who is not? But it also just is a great way to think about, you know, some of the big things that are happening now. So talk about, you know, just a novel that's fun and somewhat terrorizing in a way. And, you know, one might be tempted to call this a horror novel. No supernatural menace needs to... you know, intrude when capitalism is there to do a better job.
Yeah, I think I kind of already said this. I'm talking about something that's very real. For me, it has to be fun. You have to be able to laugh at what's going on to some degree. And using humor. I mean, I see.
I love your dry sense of humor.
Sometimes people don't get it. And it's like, oh, God, you're just mean. I'm like, no, please.
No, it's hilarious.
Thank you. I think that's important. And I think for me personally, speaking as the author of this book, having lived very traumatic experiences over and over again, I was what you would call a war baby. My parents left Sri Lanka when I was one, and I grew up with those stories. And like I said, our house was very apolitical because I guess, you know, when you leave a situation like that, you don't want to relive it, even though you are, through like conversations you have with your brothers and sisters or aunts and uncles back home. And then I think just being a woman in this society, there's just so, you walk, it's like, I see it like you're walking down a street and there's all these different corners, and behind every corner, there's a monster. And after a certain point, it's just like, you know what? I have to look at this monster and I need to make fun of him. I need to make fun of the way he looks. I need to make fun of the way he speaks. I need to make fun of the reason he feels he needs to do this to me, and not just me, but to everybody else here. And again, who is this monster and what does he represent? It has to be funny, because otherwise, like, honestly, like Dominie, she would have just killed herself. I'm laughing about it, but what else can you do? Sometimes you say these things, but it's a dark, dark world, and we have to be able to laugh at it. At the same time, do active things to change it.
When they make a movie of this, and they will you play Damani?
I would love to, but I don't know. I don't know how things are gonna work for us. I would love that though.
I've been speaking with Priya Gunz. Her new novel is Your Driver is Waiting, and I think your cat is walking on the computer.
And on my book.
Thank you very much for joining me, Damani. All right, Damani. I guess I'm losing it here. Nah, thank you for joining me, Priya.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.